The racial divide on Robben Island was absolute. There were no black warders and no white prisoners. Moving from one prison to another always requires a period of adjustment. But journeying to Robben Island was like going to another country. Its isolation made it not simply another prison, but a world of its own, far removed from the one we had come from. The high spirits with which we left Pretoria had been snuffed out by its stern atmosphere. We were face to face with the realization that our life would be unredeemably grim. In Pretoria, we felt connected to our supporters and our families. On the island, we felt cut off, and indeed, we were. We had the consolation of being with each other, but that was the only consolation. My dismay was quickly replaced by a sense that a new and different fight had begun. From the first day, I had protested about being forced to wear short trousers. I demanded to see the head of the prison and made a list of complaints. The warders ignored my protests, but by the end of the second week I found a pair of old khaki trousers unceremoniously dumped on the floor of my cell. No pinstriped three-piece suit has ever pleased me as much. But before putting them on, I checked to see if my comrades had been issued trousers as well. They had not, and I told the warder to take them back. I insisted that all African prisoners must have long trousers. The warder grumbled, "Mandela, you say you want long pants, and then you don't want them when we give them to you." The warder balked at touching trousers worn by a black man, and finally the commanding officer himself came to my cell to pick them up. "Very well, Mandela," he said. "You are going to have the same clothing as everyone else." I replied that if he was willing to give me long trousers, why couldn't everyone else have them? He did not have an answer. Chapter 60. At the end of our first 2 weeks on the island, we were informed that our lawyers, Bram Fischer and Joel Joffe, were going to be visiting the following day. When they arrived, we were escorted to the visiting area to meet them. The purpose of their visit was twofold: to see how we had settled in, and to verify that we still did not want to appeal our sentences. It had only been a few weeks since I had seen them, but it felt like an eternity. They seemed like visitors from another world. We sat in an empty room, a major just outside supervising the consultation. I felt like hugging them, but I was restrained by the presence of the major. I told them that all of us were well, and explained that we were still opposed to an appeal for all the reasons we had previously enunciated, including the fact that we did not want our appeal to interfere with the cases of other ANC defendants. Bram and Joel seemed resigned to this, though I knew Bram believed we should mount an appeal. When we were winding up our conversation, I briefly asked Bram about Molly, his wife. No sooner had I pronounced Molly's name than Bram stood up, turned away, and abruptly walked out of the room. A few minutes later, he returned, once again composed, and resumed the conversation, but without answering my question. Our meeting ended shortly afterward, and when we were walking back to our cells with the major, he said to me, "Mandela, were you struck by the behavior of Bram Fischer?" I said that I had been. He told me that Molly had died in a car accident the previous week. Bram, he said, had been driving and had swerved to avoid an animal in the road, and the car had plunged into a river. Molly had drowned. We were devastated by the news. Molly was a wonderful woman, generous and unselfish, utterly without prejudice. She had supported Bram in more ways than it was possible to know. She had been wife, colleague, and comrade. Bram had already experienced disaster in his life. His son had died of cystic fibrosis in adolescence. The act of turning away when I asked about Molly was typical of Bram's character. He was a stoic, a man who never burdened his friends with his own pain and troubles. As an Afrikaner, whose conscience forced him to reject his own heritage and be ostracized by his own people, he showed a level of courage and sacrifice that was in a class by itself. I fought only against injustice,
not my own people. I informed the major that I intended to write Brahm a condolence letter, and he responded that I could do so. The rules governing letter writing were then extremely strict. We were only permitted to write to our immediate families, and just one letter of 500 words every 6 months. I was therefore surprised and pleased when the major did not oppose my writing Brahm. But he didn't live up to his agreement. I wrote the letter and handed it over to the major, but it was never posted. Within a few months, our life settled into a pattern. Prison life is about routine. Each day like the one before, each week like the one before it, so that the months and years blend into each other. Anything that departs from this pattern upsets the authorities, for routine is the sign of a well-run prison. Routine is also comforting for the prisoner, which is why it can be a trap. Routine can be a pleasant mistress whom it is hard to resist, for routine makes the time go faster. Watches and timepieces of any kind were barred on Robben Island, so we never knew precisely what time it was. We were dependent on bells and warders' whistles and shouts. With each week resembling the one before, one must make an effort to recall what day and month it is. One of the first things I did was to make a calendar on the wall of my cell. Losing a sense of time is an easy way to lose one's grip and even one's sanity. Time slows down in prison. The days seem endless. The cliché of time passing slowly usually has to do with idleness and inactivity, but this was not the case on Robben Island. We were busy almost all the time, with work, study, resolving disputes, yet time nevertheless moved glacially. This is partially because things that took a few hours or days outside would take months or years in prison. A request for a new toothbrush might take 6 months or a year to be filled. Ahmed Kathrada once said that in prison the minutes can seem like years, but the years go by like minutes.
An afternoon pounding rocks in the courtyard might seem like forever, but suddenly it is the end of the year, and you do not know where all the months went. The challenge for every prisoner, particularly every political prisoner, is how to survive prison intact, how to emerge from prison undiminished, how to conserve and even replenish one's beliefs. The first task in accomplishing that is learning exactly what one must do to survive. To that end, one must know the enemy's purpose before adopting a strategy to undermine it. Prison is designed to break one's spirit and destroy one's resolve. To do this, the authorities attempt to exploit every weakness, demolish every initiative, negate all signs of individuality, all with the idea of stamping out that spark that makes each of us human and each of us who we are. Our survival depended on understanding what the authorities were attempting to do to us and sharing that understanding with each other. It would be very hard, if not impossible, for one man alone to resist. I do not know that I could have done it had I been alone. But the authorities' greatest mistake was keeping us together, for together our determination was reinforced. We supported each other and gained strength from each other. Whatever we knew, whatever we learned, we shared, and by sharing we multiplied whatever courage we had individually. That is not to say that we were all alike in our responses to the hardships we suffered. Men have different capacities and react differently to stress. But the stronger ones raised up the weaker ones, and both became stronger in the process. Ultimately, we had to create our own lives in prison, in a way that even the authorities acknowledged. Order in prison was preserved not by the warders, but by ourselves. As a leader, one must sometimes take actions that are unpopular, or whose results will not be known for years to come. There are victories whose glory lies only in the fact that they are known to those who win them. This is particularly true of prison, where one must find consolation in being true to one's ideals, even if no one else knows of it. I was now on the sidelines, but I also knew that I would not give up the fight. I was in a different and smaller arena, an arena for whom the only audience was ourselves and our oppressors. We regarded the struggle in prison as a microcosm of the struggle as a whole. We would fight inside as we had fought outside. The racism and repression were the same. I would simply have to fight on different terms. Prison and the authorities conspire to rob each man of his dignity. In and of itself, that assured that I would survive, for any man or institution that tries to rob me of my dignity will lose, because I will not part with it at any price or under any pressure. I never seriously considered the possibility that I would not emerge from prison one day. I never thought that a life sentence truly meant life, and that I would die behind bars. Perhaps I was denying this prospect because it was too unpleasant to contemplate, but I always knew that someday I would once again feel the grass under my feet and walk in the sunshine as a free man. I am fundamentally an optimist. Whether that comes from nature or nurture, I cannot say. Part of being optimistic is keeping one's head pointed toward the sun, one's feet moving forward. There were many dark moments when my faith in humanity was sorely tested, but I would not and could not give myself up to despair. That way lay defeat and death. Chapter 61. We were awakened at 5:30 each morning by the night warder, who clanged a brass bell at the head of our corridor and yelled, "Wake up! Get up!" I have always been an early riser, and this hour was not a burden to me. Although we were roused at 5:30, we were not let out of our cells until 6:45, by which time we were meant to have cleaned our cells and rolled up our mats and blankets. We had no running water in our cells, and instead of toilets had iron sanitary buckets known as ballies. The ballies had a diameter of 10 inches and a concave porcelain lid on the top that could contain water. The water in this lid was meant to be used for shaving and to clean our hands and faces. At 6:45, when we were let out of our cells, the first thing we did was to empty our ballies. The ballies had to be thoroughly cleansed in the sinks at the end of the hallway, or they created a stench. The only pleasant thing about cleaning one's belly was that this was the one moment in those early days when we could have a whispered word with our colleagues. The warders did not like to linger when we cleaned them, so it was a chance to talk softly. During those first few months, breakfast was delivered to us in our cells by prisoners from the general section. Breakfast consisted of mealy pap porridge, cereal made from maize or corn, which the general prisoners would slop in a bowl and then spin through the bars of our cells. It was a clever trick and required a deft hand so as not to spill any of the porridge. After a few months, breakfast was delivered to us in the courtyard in old metal oil drums. We would help ourselves to pap using simple metal bowls. We each received a mug of what was described as coffee, but which was in fact ground up maize, baked until it was black and then brewed with hot water. Later, when we were able to go into the courtyard to serve ourselves, I would go out into the courtyard and jog around the perimeter until breakfast arrived. Like everything else in prison, diet is discriminatory. In general, coloreds and Indians received a slightly better diet than Africans, but it was not much of a distinction. The authorities liked to say that we received a balanced diet. It was indeed balanced, between the unpalatable and the inedible. Food was the source of many of our protests, but in those early days, the warders would say, "Egg, you Kaffirs are eating better in prison than you ever ate at home." In the midst of breakfast, the guards would yell, "Fall in, fall in," and we would stand outside our cells for inspection. Each prisoner was required to have the three buttons of his khaki jacket properly buttoned. We were required to doff our hats as the warder walked by. If our buttons were undone, our hats unremoved, or our cells untidy, we were charged with a violation of the prison code and punished with either solitary confinement or the loss of meals. After inspection, we would work in the courtyard, hammering stones until noon.
There were no brakes. If we slowed down, the waters would yell at us to speed up. At noon, the bell would clang for lunch, and another metal drum of food would be wheeled into the courtyard. For Africans, lunch consisted of boiled mealies, that is, coarse kernels of corn. The Indian and colored prisoners received semp, or mealy rice, which consisted of ground mealies in a soup-like mixture. The semp was sometimes served with vegetables, whereas our mealies were served straight. For lunch, we often received fusamandla, which means drink of strength, a powder made from mealies and a bit of yeast. It is meant to be stirred into water or milk, and when it is thick, it can be tasty. But the prison authorities gave us so little of the powder that it barely colored the water. I would usually try to save my powder for several days until I had enough to make a proper drink. But if the authorities discovered that you were hoarding food, the powder was confiscated and you were punished. After lunch, we worked until 4, when the guards blew shrill whistles and we once again lined up to be counted and inspected. We were then permitted half an hour to clean up. The bathroom at the end of our corridor had 2 seawater showers, a saltwater tap, and 3 large galvanized metal buckets, which were used as bathtubs. There was no hot water. We would stand or squat in these buckets, soaping ourselves with the brackish water, rinsing off the dust from the day. To wash yourself with cold water when it is cold outside is not pleasant, but we made the best of it. We would sometimes sing while washing, which made the water seem less icy. In those early days, this was one of the only times that we could converse. Precisely at 4:30, there would be a loud knock on the wooden door at the end of our corridor, which meant that supper had been delivered. Common law prisoners were used to dish out the food to us, and we would return to ourselves to eat it. We again received mealy-pap porridge, sometimes with the odd carrot or piece of cabbage or beetroot thrown in, but one usually had to search for it. If we did get a vegetable, we would usually have the same one for weeks on end, until the carrots or cabbage were old and moldy and we were thoroughly sick of them. Every other day, we received a small piece of meat with our porridge. The meat was usually mostly gristle. For supper, colored and Indian prisoners received a quarter loaf of bread, known as a catcup, that is, a cat's head, after the shape of the bread, and a slab of margarine. Africans, it was presumed, did not care for bread as it was a European type of food. Typically, we received even less than the meager amounts stipulated in the regulations. This was because the kitchen was rife with smuggling. The cooks, all of whom were common law prisoners, kept the best food for themselves or their friends. Often they would lay aside the tastiest morsels for the warders in exchange for favors or preferential treatment. At 8 p.m., the night warder would lock himself in the corridor with us, passing the key through a small hole in the door to another warder outside. The warder would then walk up and down the corridor, ordering us to go to sleep. No cry of "lights out" was ever given on Robben Island, because the single mesh-covered bulb in our cell burned day and night. Later, those studying for higher degrees were permitted to read until 10 or 11. The acoustics along the corridor were quite good, and we would try to chat a bit to each other before going to sleep. But if we could hear a whisper quite clearly, so could the warder, who would yell, "Quiet in the passage!" The warder would walk up and down a few times to make sure we were not reading or writing. After a few months, we would sprinkle a handful of sand along the corridor so that we could hear the warder's footsteps and have time to stop talking or hide any contraband. Only when we were quiet did he take a seat in the small office at the end of the passage, where he dozed until morning. Chapter 62. One morning, several days after my meeting with Bram and Joel, we were taken to the head office. The head office was only about a quarter of a mile away and was a simple stone structure that resembled our own section. Once there, we were lined up to have our fingerprints taken, which was routine prison service business. But while waiting, I noticed a warder with a camera. After our fingerprints had been taken, the chief warder ordered us to line up for photographs. I motioned to my colleagues not to move, and I addressed the warder. I would like you to produce the document from the Commissioner of Prisons authorizing our pictures to be taken. Photographs of prisoners required such authorization. It was always valuable to be familiar with regulations, because the warders themselves were often ignorant of them and could be intimidated by one's superior knowledge. The warder was taken aback by my request and was unable to offer any explanation or produce anything in writing from the Commissioner of Prisons. He threatened to charge us if we did not consent to have our photographs taken, but I said that if there was no authorization, there would be no pictures, and that is where the matter remained. As a rule, we objected to having our pictures taken in prison on the grounds that it is generally demeaning to be seen as a prisoner. But there was one photograph I did consent to, the only one I ever agreed to while on Robben Island. One morning, a few weeks later, the chief warder, instead of handing us hammers for our work in the courtyard, gave us each needles and thread and a pile of worn prison jerseys. We were instructed to repair the garments, but we discovered that most of these jerseys were frayed beyond repair. This struck us as a curious task, and we wondered what had provoked the change. Later that morning, at about 11 o'clock, the front gate swung open, revealing the commanding officer with two men in suits. The commanding officer announced that the two visitors were a reporter and photographer from the Daily Telegraph in London. He related this as if visiting members of the international press were a regular diversion for us. Although these men were our first official visitors, we regarded them skeptically. Firstly, they were brought in under the auspices of the government, and second, we were aware that the Telegraph was a conservative newspaper, unlikely to be sympathetic to our cause. We well knew that there was great concern in the outside world about our situation, and that it was in the government's interest to show that we were not being mistreated. The two journalists walked slowly around the courtyard, surveying us. We kept our heads down, concentrating on our work. After they had made one circuit, one of the guards plucked me by the shoulder and said, "Mandela, come, you will talk now." In those early days, I often spoke on behalf of my fellow prisoners. The prison service regulations were explicit that each prisoner was permitted to speak only for himself. This was done to negate the power of organization and to neutralize our collective strength. We objected to this rule, but made little headway. We were not even permitted to use the word "we" when we made complaints. But during the first few years, when the authorities needed one prisoner to speak on behalf of others, that individual would be me. I talked to the reporter, whose name was Mr. Newman, for about 20 minutes, and was candid about both prison and the Rivonia trial. He was an agreeable fellow, and at the end of our talk, he said he would like the photographer to take my picture. I was reluctant, but in this case relented, because I knew the photograph would only be published overseas and might serve to help our cause if the article was even the least bit friendly. I told him I would agree, provided Mr. Sisulu could join me. The image shows the two of us talking in the courtyard about some matter that I can no longer remember. I never saw the article or heard anything about it. The reporters were barely out of sight when the warders removed the jerseys and gave us back our hammers. The men from the Telegraph were the first of a small stream of visitors during those early months. While the Rivonia trial still resonated in people's minds, the government was eager to show the international community that we were being treated properly. There were stories in the press about the inhuman conditions on the island, about how we were being assaulted and tortured. These allegations embarrassed the government, and to combat them, they brought in a string of outsiders meant to rebut these critical stories. We were briefly visited by a British lawyer who had argued for Namibian independence before the World Court, after which we were informed that a Mr. Heining, a representative of the American Bar Association, would be coming to see us. Americans were then a novelty in South Africa, and I was curious to meet a representative of so august a legal organization. On the day of Mr. Heining's visit, we were called into the courtyard. The American arrived in the company of General Stein, the commissioner of prisons, who rarely made appearances on the island. General Stein was that unusual thing in the prison service, a polished and sophisticated man. His suits were always of a fine quality and a fashionable cut. He was courtly and referred to us as gentlemen, even doffing his hat to us, something no one else in the prison service ever did. Yet General Stein oppressed us by omission rather than commission. He basically turned a blind eye to what was happening on the island. His habitual absence emboldened the more brutal prison officials and gave them carte blanche to do whatever they wanted. In his most gracious manner, the general introduced our guest and said, "Gentlemen, please select your spokesman." A number of the prisoners called out my name. General Stein nodded in my direction and I stood up. In contrast to General Stein, Mr. Heining was a heavyset, unkempt man. I thanked him for visiting us and said we were honored by his presence. I then summarized our complaints, beginning with the central and most important one, that we were political prisoners, not criminals, and that we should be treated as such. I enumerated our grievances about the food, our living conditions, and the work detail. But as I was speaking, Mr. Heining kept interrupting me. When I made a point about the long hours doing mindless work, he declared that as prisoners we had to work and were probably lazy to boot. When I started to detail the problems with our cells, he interjected that the conditions in backward American prisons were far worse than Robben Island, which was a paradise by comparison. He added that we had been justly convicted and were lucky not to have received the death penalty, which we probably deserved. Mr. Heining perspired a great deal, and there were those among us who thought he was not altogether sober. He spoke in what I assumed was a Southern American accent, and had a curious habit of spitting when he talked, something none of us had ever seen before. Finally, I had heard enough, and I interrupted him. "No, sir, you must understand the points that I am making." Heining took offense that I was now contradicting him, while General Stein watched and listened without comment. Under the circumstances, it was difficult to keep tempers down. The men were angered by Mr. Heining's remarks and annoyed that he had been permitted to see us at all. Normally, a visit of any kind lifted our spirits, but the visit of Mr. Heining was demoralizing. Perhaps that is what the authorities wanted. To meet someone with so impressive an affiliation and so little understanding was depressing. Heining finally just turned and walked away, without so much as a goodbye. We were not sorry to see him go. We discussed Mr. Heining for years afterward, and many of the men imitated the way he spoke to comic effect. We never heard about him again, and he certainly did not win any friends on Robben Island for the American Bar Association. Chapter 63. In jail, all prisoners are classified by the authorities as one of four categories: A, B, C, or D. A is the highest classification and confers the most privileges. D is the lowest and confers the least. All political prisoners, or what the authorities called security prisoners, were automatically classified as D on admission. The privileges affected by these classifications included visits and letters, studies, and the opportunity to buy groceries and incidentals, all of which are the lifeblood of any prisoner. It normally took years for a political prisoner to raise his status from D to C. We disdained the classification system. It was corrupt and demeaning, another way of repressing prisoners in general and political prisoners in particular. We demanded that all political prisoners be in one category. Although we criticized it, we could not ignore it. The classification system was an inflexible feature of prison life. If you protested that, as a D-group prisoner, you could receive only one letter every 6 months, the authorities would say, "Improve your behavior, become a C-group prisoner, and you will be able to receive two letters every 6 months." If you complained that you did not receive enough food, the authorities would remind you that if you were in A-group, you would be able to receive money orders from the outside and purchase extra food at the prison canteen. Even a freedom fighter benefits from the ability to buy groceries and books. The classifications generally ran parallel to the length of one sentence. If you were sentenced to 8 years, you would generally be classified as D for the first 2 years, C for the next two, B for the following two, and A for the last two. But the prison authorities wielded the classification system as a weapon against political prisoners, threatening to lower our hard-won classifications in order to control our behavior. Though I had been in prison for nearly 2 years before I was taken to Robben Island, I was still in D group when I arrived. While I desired the privileges that came with higher classifications, I refused to compromise my conduct. The fastest way to raise one's classification was to be docile and not complain. "Ag Mandela, you are a troublemaker," the warders would say. "You will be in D group for the rest of your life." Every 6 months, prisoners were called before the prison board to have their classifications evaluated. The board was meant to assess our behavior in terms of prison regulations, but we found that it preferred to act as a political tribunal rather than a mere evaluator of behavior. During my first meeting with the board, the officials asked me questions about the ANC and my beliefs. Although this had nothing to do with the classification system, I was vain enough to answer and think that I might convert them to my beliefs. It was one of the few times we were treated as human beings, and I, for one, responded. Later, I realized that this was simply a technique on the part of the authorities to glean information from us, and I had fallen for it. Shortly afterward, we agreed among ourselves not to discuss politics with the prison board. As a D group prisoner, I was entitled to have only one visitor and to write and receive only one letter every 6 months. I found this one of the most inhumane restrictions of the prison system. Communication with one's family is a human right. It should not be restricted by the artificial gradations of a prison system. But it was one of the facts of prison life. Visits and letters were restricted to first-degree relatives. This was a restriction we not only found irksome, but racist. The African sense of immediate family is far different from that of the European or Westerner. Our family structures are larger and more inclusive. Anyone who claims descent from a common ancestor is deemed part of the same family. In prison, the only thing worse than bad news about one's family is no news at all. It is always harder to cope with the disasters and tragedies one imagines than with the reality, however grim or disagreeable. A letter with ill tidings was always preferable to no letter at all. But even this miserable restriction was abused by the authorities. The anticipation of mail was overwhelming. Mail call took place once a month, and sometimes 6 months would go by without a letter. To be allowed one letter in 6 months and then not to receive it is a great blow. One wonders, what has happened to my wife and children, to my mother and my sisters? When I did not receive a letter, I felt as dry and barren as the great Karoo Desert. Often the authorities would withhold mail out of spite. I can remember a warder saying, "Mandela, we have received a letter for you, but we cannot give it to you." No explanation of why or whom the letter was from. It required all my self-discipline not to explode at such times. Afterward, I would protest through the proper channels and sometimes get it. When letters did arrive, they were cherished. A letter was like the summer rain that could make even the desert bloom. When I was handed a letter by the authorities, I would not rush forward and grab it as I felt like doing, but take it in a leisurely manner. Though I yearned to tear it open and read it on the spot, I would not give the authorities the satisfaction of seeing my eagerness, and I would return slowly to my cell as though I had many things to occupy me before opening a letter from my family. During the first few months, I received one letter from Winnie, but it was so heavily censored that not much more than the salutation was left. The island's censors would black out the offending passages in ink. But they later changed this when they realized we could wash away the ink and see what was underneath. They began to use razors to slice out whole paragraphs. Since most letters were written on both sides of a single piece of paper, the material on the other side would also be excised. They seemed to relish delivering letters in tatters. The censorship delayed the delivery of mail because warders, some of whom were not proficient in English, might take as long as a month to censor a letter. The letters we wrote were censored as well. They were often as cut up as the letters we received. At the end of August, after I had been on the island less than 3 months, I was informed by the authorities that I would have a visitor the following day. They would not tell me who it was. Walter was informed that he too would have a visitor, and I suspected, I hoped, I wished, I believed that it would be a visit from Winnie and Albertina. From the moment Winnie learned we had been brought to the island, she had been trying to arrange a visit. As a banned person, Winnie had to receive a special dispensation from the Minister of Justice, for she was technically not permitted to communicate with me. Even with the help of the authorities, visiting Robben Island was not an easy proposition. Visits were a maximum of 30 minutes long, and political prisoners were not permitted contact visits in which the visitor and prisoner were in the same room. Visits did not seem to be planned in advance by the authorities. One day they would contact your wife and say, "You have permission to visit your husband tomorrow." This was enormously inconvenient and often had the effect of making visits impossible. If a family member was able to plan a visit in advance, the authorities would sometimes deliberately delay issuing a permit until after the plane had departed. Since most of the men's families lived far from the Cape and had very little money, visits by family members were often far beyond their means. Some men who came from poor families did not see their wives for many years at a time, if at all. I knew of men who spent a decade or more on Robben Island without a single visit. The visiting room for non-contact visits was cramped and windowless. On the prisoner's side, there was a row of 5 cubicles with small, square pieces of glass that looked out on identical cubicles on the other side. One sat in a chair and looked through the thick, smudged glass that had a few small holes drilled into it to permit conversation. One had to talk very loudly to be heard. Later, the authorities installed microphones and speakers in front of the glass, a marginal improvement. Walter and I were called to the visitor's office in the late morning and took seats at the far end of the room. I waited with some anxiety, and suddenly, filling out the glass on the other side of the window, was Winnie's lovely face. Winnie always dressed up for prison visits and tried to wear something new and elegant. It was tremendously frustrating not to be able to touch my wife, to speak tenderly to her, to have a private moment together. We had to conduct our relationship at a distance under the eyes of people we despised. I could see immediately that Winnie was under tremendous strain. Seeing me in such circumstances must have been trying. Just getting to the island itself was difficult, and added to that were the harsh rituals of the prison, the undoubted indignities of the warders, and the impersonality of the contact. Winnie, I later discovered, had recently received a second banning order and had been terminated from her job at the Child Welfare Office as a result. Her office was searched by the police shortly before she was fired. The authorities were convinced that Winnie was in secret communication with me. Winnie loved her job as a social worker. It was the hands-on end of the struggle, placing babies with adoptive parents, finding work for the unemployed and medical help for the uninsured. The banning and harassment of my wife greatly troubled me. I could not look after her and the children, and the state was making it difficult for her to look after herself. My powerlessness gnawed at me. Our conversation was awkward at first, and was not made easier by the presence of 2 warders standing directly behind her and 3 behind me. Their role was not only to monitor, but to intimidate. Regulations dictated that conversation had to be in either English or Afrikaans. African languages were forbidden and could involve family matters only. Any line of talk that departed from the family and verged on the political might mean the abrupt termination of the visit. If one mentioned a name unfamiliar to the warders, they would interrupt the conversation and ask who the person was and the nature of the relationship. This happened often, as the warders were generally unfamiliar with the variety and nature of African names. It was frustrating to spend precious minutes of one's visit explaining to a warder the different branches of one's family tree. But their ignorance also worked in our favor. It allowed us to invent code names for people we wanted to talk about and pretend that we were referring to family members. That first visit was important, for I knew that Winnie was anxious about my health. She had heard stories that we were being physically abused. I quickly informed her that I was fine, and she could see that I was fit, though a bit thinner than before. She, too, was thinner, something I always attributed to stress. After a visit in which Winnie's face looked drawn or tense, I would urge her to put on a bit of weight. She was always dieting, and I was always telling her not to. I inquired one by one about all the children, about my mother and sisters, and Winnie's own family. Suddenly, I heard the warder behind me say, "Time up! Time up!" I turned and looked at him with incredulity. It was impossible that half an hour had passed. But, in fact, he was right. Visits always seemed to go by in the blink of an eye. For all the years that I was in prison, I never failed to be surprised when the warder called, "Time up!" Winnie and I were both hustled from our chairs, and we waved a quick farewell. I always felt like lingering after Winnie left, just to retain the sense of her presence, but I would not let the warders see such emotion. As I walked back to the cell, I reviewed in my head what we had talked about. Over the next days, weeks, and months, I would return to that one visit again and again. I knew I would not be able to see my wife again for at least 6 months. As it turned out, Winnie was not able to visit me for another 2 years. Chapter 64. One morning in early January, as we lined up to be counted before beginning work in the courtyard, we were instead marched outside and ordered into a covered truck. It was the first time that we had left our compound. No announcement was made as to our destination, but I had an idea of where we were headed. A few minutes later, we emerged from the truck in a place that I had first seen when I was on the island in 1962, the Lime Quarry. The Lime Quarry looked like an enormous white crater cut into a rocky hillside. The cliffs and the base of the hillside were blindingly white. At the top of the quarry were grass and palm trees, and at the base was a clearing with a few old metal sheds. We were met by the commanding officer, Colonel Vessels, a rather colorless fellow who cared only about strict adherence to prison regulations. We stood at attention as he told us that the work we would be doing would last 6 months, and afterward we would be given light tasks for the duration of our terms. His timing was considerably off. We remained at the quarry for the next 13 years. After the CO's speech, we were handed picks and shovels and given rudimentary instructions as to the mining of lime. Mining lime is not a simple task. That first day, we were clumsy with our new tools and extracted little. The lime itself, which is the soft, calcified residue of seashells and coral, is buried in layers of rock, and one had to break through to it with a pick and then extract the seam of lime with a shovel. This was far more strenuous than the work in the courtyard, and after our first few days on the quarry, we fell asleep immediately after our supper at 4:30 in the afternoon. We woke the next morning, aching and still tired. The authorities never explained why we had been taken from the courtyard to the quarry. They may simply have needed extra lime for the island's roads. But when we later discussed the transfer, we assumed it was another way of enforcing discipline,
of showing us that we were not different from the general prisoners who worked in the island's stone quarry, and that we had to pay for our crimes just as they did. It was an attempt to crush our spirits. But those first few weeks at the quarry had the opposite effect on us. Despite blistered and bleeding hands, we were invigorated. I much preferred being outside in nature, being able to see grass and trees, to observe birds flitting overhead, to feel the wind blowing in from the sea. It felt good to use all of one's muscles, with the sun at one's back, and there was simple gratification in building up mounds of stone and lime. Within a few days, we were walking to the quarry rather than going by truck, and this too was a tonic. During our 20-minute march to the quarry, we got a better sense of the island and could see the dense brush and tall trees that covered our home, and smell the eucalyptus blossoms, spot the occasional springbok or kudu grazing in the distance. Although some of the men regarded the march as drudgery, I never did. Although our work at the quarry was meant to show us that we were no different from the other prisoners, the authorities still treated us like the lepers who once populated the island. Sometimes we would see a group of common law prisoners working by the side of the road, and their warders would order them into the bushes so they would not see us as we marched past. It was as if the mere sight of us might somehow affect their discipline. Sometimes, out of the corner of an eye, we could see a prisoner raise his fist in the ANC salute. Near the quarry, the dirt road diverged, and to the right, the general prisoners trooped off to the rock quarry. This crossroads was later to become an important site of communications with them. Where the road branched, we could see in the brush the small white cottage where Robert Subukwe lived. The house had been built for a black warder years before, and now Subukwe lived in it by himself. It was a tiny plot, unkempt and overgrown, and one would not even know that anyone lived there except for the guard who stood in front. Subukwe's sentence had ended in 1963, but under what became known as the Subukwe Clause of the General Law Amendment Act of 1963, the Minister of Justice could hold political prisoners indefinitely without charge. That is precisely what they did with Bob. For 6 years, Subukwe lived a kind of half-life on the island. He was a free man who was denied his liberty. Sometimes we were able to get a glimpse of him in his garden, but that was all. After arriving in the morning, we would fetch our picks, shovels, hammers, and wheelbarrows from a zinc shed at the top of the quarry. Then we would array ourselves along the quarry face, usually in groups of three or four. Warders with automatic weapons stood on raised platforms watching us. Unarmed warders walked among us, urging us to work harder. "Go on! Go on!" they would shout as if we were oxen. By 11, when the sun was high in the sky, we would begin to flag. By that time, I would already be drenched in sweat. The warders would then drive us even harder. "No, man! Come on! Come on!" they would shout. Just before noon, when we would break for lunch, we would pile the lime into wheelbarrows and cart it over to the truck, which would take it away. At midday, a whistle would blow, and we would make our way to the bottom of the hill. We sat on makeshift seats under a simple zinc shed shielding us from the sun. The warders ate at a larger shed with tables and benches. Drums of boiled mealies were delivered to us. Hundreds of seagulls, screaming and swooping, circled above us as we ate, and a well-aimed dropping could sometimes spoil a man's lunch. We worked until 4, when we again carted the lime to the waiting truck. By the end of the day, our faces and bodies were caked with white dust. We looked like pale ghosts except where rivulets of sweat had washed away the lime. When we returned to our cells, we would scrub ourselves in the cold water, which never seemed to completely rinse away the dust. Worse than the heat at the quarry was the light. Our backs were protected from the sun by our shirts, but the sun's rays would be reflected into our eyes by the lime itself. The glare hurt our eyes and, along with the dust, made it difficult to see. Our eyes teared, and our faces became fixed in a permanent squint. It would take a long time after each day's work for our eyes to adjust to the diminished light. After our first few days at the quarry, we made an official request for sunglasses. The authorities refused. This was not unexpected, for we were then not even permitted reading glasses. I had previously pointed out to the commanding officer that it did not make sense to permit us to read books, but not permit us glasses to read them with. During the following weeks and months, we requested sunglasses again and again. But it was to take us almost 3 years before we were allowed to have them, and that was only after a sympathetic physician agreed that the glasses were necessary to preserve our eyesight. Even then, we had to purchase the glasses ourselves. For us, such struggles for sunglasses, long trousers, study privileges, equalized food were corollaries to the struggle we waged outside prison. The campaign to improve conditions in prison was part of the apartheid struggle. It was, in that sense, all the same. We fought injustice wherever we found it, no matter how large or how small, and we fought injustice to preserve our own humanity. Shortly after we started working at the quarry, we were joined in Section B by a number of other prominent political prisoners. Several were MK men who had been arrested in July of 1964 and convicted of more than 50 acts of sabotage in what became known as the Little Rivonia Trial. These included Mac Maharaj, a member of the SACP and one of the sharpest minds in the struggle, Lalu Chiba, also a member of the MK High Command and a stalwart colleague who proved a great asset in prison, and Wilton Nkwai, the treason trialist who had been mistakenly let go during a moment of confusion when the state of emergency was declared in 1960. He had left South Africa secretly, received military training, and become commander-in-chief of MK after the Rivonia trial. We were also joined by Eddie Daniels, a colored member of the Liberal Party who had been convicted for sabotage operations undertaken by the African Resistance Movement, a small sabotage group composed of members of the Liberal Party. Eddie was to become one of my greatest friends in prison. To counterbalance the effect of these new political allies, the authorities also put a handful of common law prisoners in our section. These men were hardened criminals convicted of murder, rape, and armed robbery. They were members of the island's notorious criminal gangs, either the Big Fives or the 28s, which terrorized other prisoners. They were brawny and surly, and their faces bore the scars of the knife fights that were common among gang members. Their role was to act as agents provocateurs, and they would attempt to push us around, take our food, and inhibit any political discussions we tried to have. One of these fellows was known as Bogart, after the American tough guy movie actor. He had a cell opposite Walter's, and Walter used to complain that he would demand Walter's breakfast from him each morning, and that he was too scared to refuse. The gang members worked in their own clique apart from us at the quarry. One day, they began singing what sounded like a work song. In fact, it was a famous work song with their own adapted lyrics. Beni Funani I Rivonia, which means, "What did you want at Rivonia?" The next line was something like, "Did you think that you would become the government?" They sang exuberantly and with a mocking tone. They had obviously been encouraged by the warders, who were hoping that the song would provoke us. Although the more hot-headed among us wanted to confront them, instead we decided to fight fire with fire. We had far more and better singers among us than they had, and we huddled together and planned our response. Within a few minutes, we were all singing the song Stimela, a rousing anthem about a train making its way down from southern Rhodesia. Stimela is not a political song, but in the context, it became one, for the implication was that the train contained guerrillas coming down to fight the South African army. For a number of weeks, our two groups sang as we worked, adding songs and changing lyrics. Our repertoire increased, and we were soon singing overt political songs such as Amajoni, a song about guerrilla soldiers, the title of which was a corruption of the English slang word for soldier, Johnny, and Shushuloza, a song that compares the struggle to the motion of an oncoming train. If you say the title over and over, it mimics the sound of the train. We sang a song about the Freedom Charter, and another about the Transkei, whose lyrics said, "There are two roads. One road is the Matanzima Road, and one road is the Mandela Road. Which one will you take?" The singing made the work lighter. A few of the fellows had extraordinary voices, and I often felt like putting my pick down and simply listening. The gang members were no competition for us. They soon became quiet while we continued singing. But one of the warders was fluent in Xhosa and understood the content of our songs, and we were soon ordered to stop singing. Whistling was also banned. From that day on, we worked in silence. I saw the gang members not as rivals, but as raw material to be converted. There was a non-political prisoner among us, nicknamed Joe My Baby, who later joined the ANC and proved invaluable in helping us smuggle material in and out of prison. One day we heard that Bogart had been savagely beaten by a warder at the quarry. I did not see the assault, but I saw the results. His face cut and badly bruised, Bogart approached me in our corridor and asked for help. I immediately agreed to take up his case. We were always looking for ways to stand up to the authorities, and the report of a beating was the kind of incident we could raise with the head office. Shortly before this, we had learned that a certain PAC man named Ganya had been beaten by a warder. In my role as an attorney, I wrote a letter to the Commissioner of Prisons protesting on behalf of Ganya. I was brought to the head office, where I was confronted by prison officials. In the same breath, they denied that the beating had occurred and wanted to know how I had heard about it. I insisted that the warder who had beaten Ganya be removed from the island. They refused, saying there was no evidence against him. But shortly afterward, the warder in question was transferred off the island. I had been emboldened by this case, so when Bogart asked for help, I immediately demanded to see the commanding officer. The next day I was summoned to the head office, where the commander blandly informed me that the case had been investigated and dismissed. "That's a violation of regulations," I said. "The case must be tried." "No," he said. "We have attempted to interview the so-called complainant, and he denies that he was ever assaulted." "That's impossible," I said. "I spoke to him only yesterday." The commander gestured to a lieutenant and said, "Then see for yourself." The lieutenant led Bogart into the room. His face was covered with bandages. The commander asked him whether or not he had been beaten. "No, boss," he said quietly, without meeting my gaze. "I was never assaulted." He was then dismissed. "Well, Mandela," the commander said, "the case is closed." The commander had succeeded in humiliating me. He had obviously bribed Bogart with extra food and tobacco to drop his charges. From that point on, I demanded a signed and written statement from a prisoner before I agreed to take up his case. Chapter 65. One day in the summer of 1965, we discovered some fat glistening on our porridge at breakfast and chunks of fresh meat with our pep at supper. The next day, some of the men received new shirts. The guards at the quarry and the warders in our section seemed a bit more deferential. All of us were suspicious. In prison, no improvement happens without a reason. A day later, we were notified that the International Red Cross would be arriving the following day. This was a crucial occasion, more important than any of our previous visitors. The Red Cross was responsible and independent, an international organization to whom the Western powers and the United Nations paid attention. The prison authorities respected the Red Cross, and by respected I mean feared, for the authorities respected only what they were afraid of. The prison service distrusted all organizations that could affect world opinion, and regarded them not as legitimate investigators to be dealt with honestly, but as meddling interlopers to be hoodwinked if possible. Avoiding international condemnation was the authorities' principal goal. In those early years, the International Red Cross was the only organization that both listened to our complaints and responded to them. This was vital because the authorities ignored us. Regulations required that the authorities provide some